Good morning. We are preaching through the book of James, and we're in week three this week. And there's a big theme in the book of James about not just talking the talk, but walking the walk as well. And today, I am talking about not discriminating. Don't discriminate is the title of my talk. And I very much doubt that there's anyone sitting here who will hear that and think, oh man, I love to discriminate. Very few people, if any, in our culture think that discrimination is a good thing. However, I do think it's a good example of something where we can talk the talk quite well about it while not actually necessarily being walking the walk. Now, let me illustrate. Over the summer, my amazing wife took me for my birthday to see Hamilton at the theatre, a musical about the forming of America as a nation, and it's kind of hip-hop. Michelle Obama said it is the best piece of art she's ever seen in her life, and I'm fully behind that. I totally agree. It's amazing. It's great. And in the forming of the nation of America, the founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton is the lead person, and he's one of the founding fathers, they penned the Declaration of Independence, which you may well have heard of. Super famous document for Americans, certainly. And it's based on Christian and biblical morals, the whole document. It is a phenomenal piece of literature. And it was written 1776, the year 1776, on 4th of July, Independence Day for Americans. And probably the most famous line is this one, which starts with, which is in a song, so I have to sing this bit. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Anyway, done. I'm done singing. Now I'll read it. I couldn't resist. This is the Declaration of Independence, probably the most famous line from it. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That is an incredible, it's a beautiful sentence. It's amazing. It's very, very well constructed, and it's a beautiful sentiment. All humans have God-given rights. All people are equal and should be treated equally. This is the Declaration of Independence that America was founded on. And when it says men, by the way, that just genuinely refers to all people. It's how language was used in those days in a way that maybe it isn't now. We hear it and we think males, but no, genuinely meant all people are created equal. And that's a great theory, right? They're talking the talk as well as anyone. But here's just two facts, right, about how they maybe walk the walk. It wasn't until 1920, August 18th, 1920, which is 144 years later, that women could vote in America. So what they're saying, genuinely saying, we're saying all people are created equal. Women couldn't vote until 144 years later, so maybe not exactly equal. And then very famously, it wasn't until 1964, the 2nd of July, 188 years after this declaration was written, that the Civil Rights Act was passed in America, which made discrimination based on race or gender or age or anything, but particularly race, illegal. It ended segregation, where white people could live the life and sit where they like on a bus, and people of colour had to sit at the back of a bus. And now, 55 years on from that, racism is still a battle in America. What the point of saying this is to illustrate, it is easy to talk the talk really well, but not actually be walking the walk when it comes to discrimination and showing partiality. Now, I'm not having a go at America by any means. I'm not saying that we're any better, and maybe more subtle than us, but we're not. I'm just using this Declaration of Independence to illustrate how easy it can be to talk the talk and not walk the walk. Obviously, we probably are all anti-discrimination, but let's make sure we are not just claiming to hold to one thing while our actual practice reflects something different. Now, are there ways that we can show favoritism or discrimination? That's what I want to be talking about today. It's what our passage is really looking at. And we're in James chapter 2. And I'm going to just read the first verse initially, and then I'll read the rest in a moment. But just a couple of observations from verse 1. James 2, 1. My brothers and sisters, believers in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ, must not show favoritism. Right, there it is. So first thing just to say on that, James, David mentioned on week one of our series, James is Jesus' half-brother, right? They got the same mum. Now, all the evidence, historically, seems to suggest that while Jesus was doing his ministry on earth and going around and teaching and healing, for that period, it looks like James, the guy who wrote this book, did not think that Jesus was the Son of God. That's what seems to be the case. Why is that? It's probably because that's what happens when you have a brother. Now, I've never had a brother, but I've got two little boys, obviously brothers, and I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying that when you have a brother, you tend to not think that they are a deity, right? You tend to not think that your brother is God. But then we get to this, and he's calling him our glorious Lord Jesus Christ. He's taken it all back and saying, actually, his half-brother Jesus is God in the flesh. He is our glorious Lord Jesus Christ. What's changed? I think it is that Jesus died and then came back to life again. That is a trump card if you want to prove that you are God. And if you want your brother to call you God, you die and come back to life. That's what happens. Remarkable. Just worth noting. And the other thing, just on that first verse, this is a message from James to fellow believers in Jesus, right? So this, what I'm going to say really is a message for Christians. It is a message, a standard by which Christians should be living. Now, it's not to say that there's not a message for people who aren't yet Christians this morning. There certainly is, and I'll highlight that later. But it's just to say there's no judgment to unbelievers. This standard that James holds us to is a standard that he holds believers to. Right, so let me read the rest of the passage. Let's read it together. James 2, I'll read verse 1 again. My brothers and sisters, believers in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ must not show favoritism. Suppose a man comes into your meeting wearing a gold ring and fine clothes, and a poor man in filthy old clothes also comes in. If you show special attention to the man wearing fine clothes and say, here's a good seat for you, but say to the poor man, you sit there or sit on the floor by my feet, have you not discriminated among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts? Listen, my dear brothers and sisters, has not God chosen those who are poor in the eyes of the world to be rich in faith and to inherit the kingdom he promised those who love him? But you have dishonored the poor. Is it not the rich who are exploiting you? Are they not the ones who are dragging you into court? And are they not the ones who are blaspheming the noble name of him to whom you belong? If you really keep the royal law found in Scripture, love your neighbour as yourself, you are doing right. But if you show favouritism, you sin and are convicted by the law as lawbreakers. For whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles at just one point is guilty of breaking all of it. For he who said, you shall not commit adultery, also said, you shall not murder. If you do not commit adultery, but you commit murder, you have become a lawbreaker. Speak and act as those who are going to be judged by the law that gives freedom. Because judgment without mercy will be shown to anyone who has not been merciful. Mercy triumphs over judgment. It's kind of a weighty passage. What we're going to be doing, I've got a what, a why, and a how. That's where we're going. So what is the message? What is James saying? Why is he saying that? Why is he saying that? And then we'll land with how do we motivate ourselves towards that. So firstly, the what, as I've said, the what is don't discriminate. Don't show partiality. Don't show favoritism. It's all different ways of saying the same thing. James is like super practical. There's clear application for us here. It's great. He says it how he is. And so it's easy for us to get some application. So some comments. What are we saying? Don't discriminate. Just I think it's important we realize that when we're talking about this, the world that we live in, our culture is not the model of non-discrimination. Discrimination is kind of a buzzword these days in the world. Everyone is against it, right? Pretty much everyone is against it. And that's a good thing, of course. But let's not be seduced by thinking that the world is getting it right and we need to just follow in their footsteps. Now, actually, James's culture clearly was pretty messed up and sick that the things like this might have been happening. And our culture is still messed up and confused, just like James's. The example James gives of, don't kind of welcome a rich man like that and a poor man like that, that actually would have been kind of normal practice. He says, a man comes in wearing a gold ring, fine clothes, and a poor man in filthy old clothes. If you show special attention to the man wearing the clothes, fine clothes, and say, here's a good seat for you, say to the poor man, you stand there or sit on the floor, have you not discriminated among yourselves? I mean, people would have done that in other contexts in that culture. So maybe even in the temple, but in other places, people would openly treat the rich differently to how they would treat the poor. And we're not quite like that in our culture, but we're still in a broken world. So you've got places like the Ritz, right, that are exclusively for rich people, or at the very least, people who pretend to be rich for the day. You can't go in if you can't afford to get nice clothes, let alone eat there. Life is made easier for rich people in our culture. Rich people buy things and they can afford to buy them outright, while poorer people have to pay in expensive installments and get expensive loans. Mortgages favour the rich. Money breeds money in our culture. Our world discriminates by giving time and attention and adulation to the rich and the famous and the sexy in a way it's not giving attention to the poor and the lowly. Companies, right? Companies clearly discriminate despite laws to prevent it. No one's saying that they're doing it, but they're going around ways of doing it. The system discriminates. We are living in the fruit of the slave trade still. And our ancestors who showed partiality, right? We are rich in this country because our ancestors discriminated against people who hadn't essentially developed the technology to make guns yet. And so they could overthrow them and then exploit them. And we are still living in the fruit of that. I think much of the problem in our culture is this. People confuse disagreeing with someone with discriminating against someone. So that we're actually not sure often how to distinguish between disagreeing and discriminating anymore. If you disagree with beliefs and practices, you can be accused of discriminating. And they can be linked. Obviously you can disagree with someone and discriminate at the same time, but they're not necessarily linked. Sometimes even it is those who disagree that far from being those that discriminate are those that are discriminated against, right? So it's, we don't discriminate against anyone unless you disagree with us. You can discriminate in disagreeing, but they aren't the same thing. And that, I think, is just where our culture gets confused. Now, this is the opposite of a rant at our culture. It's just a warning to us as God's people to not think that they've got it right, the culture's got it right, and we need to follow in their footsteps. That's not the case. Another thing, discriminating is more subtle than we think. Now, often people who discriminate are genuinely blind to it. They genuinely don't realize that they're doing it. They don't think they're doing it. I mean, it's the irony, isn't it, that often those that start a sentence with, I'm not racist, but, often they go on to say something that is clearly racist. And they may genuinely don't think that they are being racist, because I think discrimination can often be subtle. Again, no one in our culture is doing what James gave that example of. No one is kind of talking to the rich like that and talking to the poor like that. It's more subtle for us, I think. So what do we do? I think we gravitate to what we know and to what is familiar to us, whoever we are. So if we're pretty well off financially, then we gravitate to that. And if we're struggling financially, maybe we gravitate to that as well. It's just natural human nature. We gravitate to what we know and what we're familiar with. And also, we gravitate to things that we can get something out of. And not necessarily even in an awful way, but we gravitate to people that we enjoy talking to. So even if it's just that we get a nice encouragement and a conversation with, we gravitate to that rather than gravitating to people that we can give something to and encourage, even if we think it might be a conversation that might drain us a bit. Now, we all like I said, we all like talk against discrimination. But how are we actually living that out? How are we actually walking the walk? Here's some questions just for us to self-assess. Not condemnation, but just to help us to get a bit real about how whether or not we are showing partiality in any way. So firstly, who do you talk to on a Sunday? Is it always those you know? Is it those you enjoy talking to? You know, again, those you can get something out of, even if it's just a nice conversation. Or are we spending our time talking to those you can, you know, show kindness to? Maybe not like you. Not necessarily like you. There might be. But how are you choosing who you spend your time talking to on a Sunday when we meet together as God's people? So how excited do you get, right, when you hear you have a new person that is a lawyer or something versus someone who is on benefits and struggling with life? Do we naturally, honestly, self-assess, think, oh yeah, you see, it's like really look like they're coming in and, you know, it's great, they've got good family, and then where someone who's coming in, they've got a difficult situation, do we get excited? Do we react in a different way? Also, who have you had in your house over the last year? Who have you had round? Have you had single people? Have you had married people? Have you had old people or young people? Maybe just having family units round, people with steady jobs. Have you had any vulnerable people? Had any people that you feel vulnerable around a little bit even? It's not judgment. What I'm saying is no one is doing what James is saying, but none of us are scoring a perfect score on those questions. None of us are totally faultless when it comes to not discriminating, even if it's more subtle than we think. Now let's thank God that we are a mixed bunch of people, right? Grace Church is made up of a range of ages and ethnicities and social classes and wealth, and that is great. That we have diversity among us is a sign of God's blessing. You just got to make sure that the richer among us must be mixing with the poorer and vice versa. So the poorer must not be putting the richer on a pedestal and not looking to connect there either. Certainly, we shouldn't look down on anyone who is struggling financially, but we shouldn't kind of look up to others who are better off either and think, oh, that's what I must aim to be, and think they're unapproachable. So don't discriminate. Put positively, what James is saying is the opposite, right? And he says it in two various ways. He says it first, or he says it in verses 8 and 9. He says the opposite, okay, of not discriminating. If you really keep the royal law found in Scripture, love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing right. But if you show favoritism, you sin and are convicted by the law. So the opposite of showing favoritism is generally loving your neighbor as yourself. That's the opposite. It's love. But it gets more specific, actually, earlier on in that. The example of how you treat a rich person versus how you treat a poorer person, he's more specific in the opposite of showing favoritism. Implicitly, he's saying is that it is to welcome everyone equally. That's what we should be doing. Do welcome everyone. So let me just talk on welcoming everyone equally, because that is actually the primary context of this passage. Now James is saying don't show partiality in any way, but certainly when you gather together, make sure you are welcoming to everyone equally. Now, maybe this may be your first time at Grace Church today, in which case you are so, so welcome. And you know what it feels like to be in a place that you've not been before, and it can be uncomfortable. Maybe the rest of us, maybe you remember your first time going into Grace Church or any other church, and you can remember how vulnerable you feel. Now, I think I get something of that when I go into the hairdressers, right? So up until a couple of years ago, I basically cut my own hair, spent my life doing that. And then, I don't know, I guess it got to a point where my wife said, enough was enough. I don't need to go and get someone who knows what they're doing to do it. And so I went into a hairdresser, and I've been doing it a couple of years, I still really don't like it, because I feel like an outsider. I don't know what's the decorum in a hairdresser's. You know, I go in and do I say hello? Do I tell someone I'm here for a haircut? Do I just sit in that chair? Do I sit in the kind of waiting line chair over there? And they say, oh, you know, what would you like today? And I thought, oh, a haircut. I don't know how to explain what I want doing. I feel like an outsider, and it's a strange thing. That will be how many people feel coming into church. They don't know the decorum, so we therefore need to work hard to make people feel welcome. So what I've got three rules of engagement. Now, I've stolen these from a lady called Rebecca McLaughlin, who is an English Oxbridge graduate who's kind of moved to America now and just does some amazing stuff. I picked these up on Twitter. She tweeted them. I just thought they're great. So these are three rules of engagement for making people feel welcome on a Sunday. So number one, an alone person in our gathering is an emergency. So they may be, you know, cool and trendy or wearing an expensive suit. They may be a group that is alone even and still just kind of got that looking around, don't really know where to go and what to do. Might be a family unit that's alone, might be a gay couple. It might be a random bunch of people. We don't really know who's connected to who, but they're definitely on their own and they don't really know who to talk to. They might smell of alcohol, they might smell of weed, and that genuinely these people might be there and you see them on their own and they don't know what they're doing. That is an emergency and something needs to be done about it. That's number one. Number two, friends can wait. So you're talking to someone, you chat to, and you see an alone person, the friends can wait. So here's what that looks like on the outside, those two played out, right? So maybe you're chatting to a friend and, you know, it's like, oh, how's your week been? Oh, yeah, it's all right. And then you spot an alone person over there. And here's what it looks like. You just think, oh, sorry, Paul. I've just seen someone in there. They look like they're on their own. I'm just going to go and I'll catch up with you later. I'm just going to go and chat to that person, say hello. That's what it looks like. Okay, and then you walk over and say, hi, just thought I'd say hello, and don't know, you've been here before. Here's what it looks like on the inside, right? Here's what's going on inside your head, okay? So you're talking, how'd you been? Yeah, all right. And you see the alone person, and your head goes, emerge, red alert, alone person, emergency. And you get out of the way, I'm done talking to you, and you run over and talk. And you welcome this person and you say hello. Very important you don't get the what's going on inside your head mixed up with what's going outside your head. Don't actually push anyone out of the way or do weird siren noises. But you see what I'm saying. It is an emergency, an urgent thing. And you can just say, can I just catch you later? I'm trying to go and say hello. Number three, introduce a newcomer to someone else. Just say, oh, yeah, maybe learn something about them. Oh, this is their first time. He lives just around the corner and say, hey, Jenny, meet Paul. And say, oh, Jenny's never been before, lives just around the corner. Maybe they have been before, but they're still alone and they're not really integrated. Just introduce them. You're not palming them off on them and saying, right, see you later. Actually, no. And another thing is it's good. Why not invite them to come and sit with you? Say, hey, come and sit with me. Maybe they'll think, oh, that's a bit overly welcoming, but it is way better that we are overly welcoming then someone might come in to our gathering, sit down on their own and leave and not talk to anyone. So that's the kind of the what. Don't discriminate. This is not an attack on rich people. It is an appeal. Nor is it an appeal to reverse discrimination, right? It is an attack on the idea that we all need to be rich and have well-organized lives and families in order to be a Christian. And it is an appeal for all of us to be loving one another equally. Poorer love the richer love the poorer, younger love the older loving the younger. You get it. We're not saying anything goes. You come in, anything goes here, whatever. But we are saying anyone can come. Anyone can receive the same welcome as anyone else. Remember, being welcoming doesn't mean that you endorse all their beliefs and all their life choices. That's confusing disagreeing with discriminating. Being welcoming just means you're loving them and being kind. That's the what. What about the why? Why don't discriminate? Why do we get that? There's one overriding. Actually, there's kind of a lot of reasons given in here, but there's one overriding reason. And it's not at all just because God says so, right? Don't do that. That's obviously a bad thing. Primarily, we do not discriminate because discriminating, if we were to discriminate, would show that we have not really understood Christianity or understood the gospel at all. We are not picked like you pick football teams at school. Really, we have never been worth saving as Christians, right? So at school, I don't know if they still do it, but you'd get the two best and two best like footballers or something, and then they would then pick teams, and they would pick the best players in descending order. You say, oh, I have him, and I have him, and until you get, you know, to the kid who can't run 5 meters without falling over, who is genuinely a hindrance to your team. So it's not like, oh, okay, come and make up the numbers. It's they make your team worse, right? Now, I'm loving you by saying that you are not really that awesome. You're not in God's family. You have not been chosen by God because of anything that you brought to the team. Verses 9 and 10 say, if you have discriminated in any way, you've broken the law. It's saying we've all messed up. It says in 1 Corinthians 1:26 to 28, Paul says this, brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. It's the kids that can't run and know they can't that God saves. We are them. That is us. God has not picked us on our own worthiness. He has shown mercy to us. God has shown mercy to us. So how could we now discriminate against anyone since God has not discriminated against us, despite actually there maybe being good reason for him to do so? To show favoritism to anyone would be to totally undermine the gospel and message of grace that saved us. Discriminating, it means that we make ourselves like mini gods, judging others by our own skewed standards. It means we think we have a better way than God's. It dishonors God, who chose us despite our unworthiness. It dishonors others, and it totally misrepresents the gospel that we are called to model to others and tell others about. Beautifully and graciously, we don't stay as a hindrance to the team, right? God transforms us and adopts us as sons and daughters. He fills us with his spirit and equips us to serve him. But that is all still an act of his mercy. God has been merciful to us. Now we must show mercy to others. It's not about whether people deserve it, but what God has done for us. It's kind of a heavy message. Verse 13, for judgment is without mercy to one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. James really is echoing, he's kind of commentating on his half-brother Jesus, who said in Matthew 5, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. James has just flipped that and said, those who show no mercy will receive no mercy. The message is not Christians must not show partiality or you will cease to be a Christian. The message is that Christians are those that know God has chosen them, even though they have nothing to offer. So if you're not loving others regardless of their worthiness, you've not understood the gospel. If we discriminate because of riches or race or gender or age or ability or anything else, then we do not know Christ. We will perish. But if we have tasted his mercy, then we will show mercy. And that mercy will be the evidence of the work that God has done in us. Right? Showing mercy doesn't make you a Christian. But if you are a Christian, then you will show mercy. Not all people who show mercy and care for the poor are Christians. Not saying that, but I'm saying that all Christians will inevitably care for the poor. So we have the what and the why it matters. How do we motivate ourselves though? Now it is not just do better, try harder, be better. No, actually, we're sons and daughters. We're not slaves. But it is, remember God's mercy to you. So we never move on from the grace and mercy that saved us and made us children of God. So James, this book is so not about forgetting grace. Right, you've had grace. Now move on to actually doing some stuff. It is about centering ourselves on it so much that we accept it and enjoy it and it overflows out of us into how we act. If it never overflows out of us, then it's not in us at all. Tim Keller leads a church in New York. He says this on this subject. I think it's just really helpful. He says, a merely religious person who believes God will favor him because of his morality and respectability will ordinarily have contempt for the outcast. I worked hard to get where I am, and so can anyone else. That is the language of the moralist's heart. But he says this in contrast, I am only where I am by the sheer and unmerited mercy of God. I am completely equal with all other people. That is the language of the Christian heart. A sensitive social conscience and a life poured out in deeds of mercy to the needy is the inevitable sign of a person who has grasped the doctrine of God's grace. It's just really helpful. We are only Christians because of the sheer and unmerited mercy of God. The way for us to be a people that does not discriminate, but instead loves others as we love ourselves generally, but then specifically to welcome everyone equally in every way, the only way for us to do that is to remember God's mercy and lean constantly on it to save us and sustain us. So this passage ends by saying mercy triumphs over judgment. Now that's not to say that for Christians, God chooses to hold off on judgment and, you know, forget judgment or justice and just show mercy. Christians just have mercy. No, God must be just. He must show judgment. You can't have justice without judgment. He must show judgment for our sin and rejection of him. But what it means is that he has moved his judgment. He's been so merciful as to take the judgment that we deserve and place it somewhere else, namely onto his only son, Jesus, who did not deserve judgment. And Jesus has taken our sin and the things we have done, our rejection of God, he's taken that, put it on him, and in so doing has said he is willing to take the judgment that our sin deserves. Now that's the message for the non-Christian, as well as the Christian. You, if you're an unbeliever, you can be welcomed into God's family, even though you don't deserve it. None of us deserved it either. But Jesus has paid for your sin, and you can receive the mercy of God instead. We are nothing special, Christians, but we have received the grace of God, and anyone else can receive it too. And for Christians, how to motivate ourselves to mercy and not discriminating, we never move on from getting caught up in how merciful God has been to us. Remembering God's mercy in your own life to judge Jesus in our place is how we are to let mercy triumph over judgment of others in our own lives. That is how we walk the walk as well as talking the talk and become doers and not just hearers. It's by never moving on from the mercy shown to us in Jesus.
That's quite a message, isn't it? Very practical. And for us as Christians, I think there's really, in all honesty, only one way to respond to that, and that is to come before God and just be thankful for how he has treated us. So if you'd like to stand, but before we do so, there may be those of you in the room who don't know Jesus, and you're looking at that message and you're thinking, well, hang on a minute. If that's the way that Jesus wants me to be, and if that's the way that he treats those who deserve nothing, then I want to get to know this Jesus. And maybe now's the opportunity that you can do that. So while we sing this song, two things can go on here. One is just a recognition that God has been so merciful to us, so gracious to us, and we can give him thanks and praise for that. But maybe for some, it's a point at which you just come and almost step forward in your own life and say, if you're like that, God, I want you in my life. And at this point, I want to surrender my life to you. So if that's you, you can be doing that during this song. And just do business with God. Do business with this Jesus who died for you and who is offered to take all of your sin, everything that you've done wrong, everything that which would separate you from a holy God, upon himself, so that you could be free of it. And then, more than that, to turn around and give you the amazing life that he has for you, so that you can enjoy it with him. So let's worship and let's do business with God.